Hi, welcome to Eerie Theories. I'm Luna.
And I'm Tasha.
We are joined by Stacey and Nate.
Hello.
Hi.
It's their first episode of Eerie Theories. We're letting them join us.
Letting them join the cool kids.
Yeah.
Join us.
Finally let them do Eerie Theories with the girls.
We did one sort of Eerie Theories, kind of Halloween-y, not so live episode last year, didn't we?
Oh yeah, we did.
Kind of a crossover. But that was more you joined us as opposed to we joined you, so.
We gate crashed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was fun.
We also had, everyone else was busy because it was Halloween. Like, they all had their own things to do, so we couldn't get guests. So I was like, it's fine.
We're not the backup guests.
Rude. We're the best guests.
Yes.
Anyway, carry on. Totally off topic.
I'm going to start my eerie theories.
Eerie theories.
Eerie theories. With the Cecil Hotel, or Stay on Main, is what it's been rebranded as. The Cecil Hotel opened December 20th, 1924, as a budget hotel on Main Street, Los Angeles. It was built by William Banks Hanna, Charles L. Dix, and Robert H. Shops.
Dix.
It cost $1.5 million to build, and was known to be very lavish and popular amongst the wealthy tourists. Within 5 years of opening, the Great Depression hit, and its once high status began to decline. The neighbouring area known as Skid Row also didn't help with the hotel's reputation, and there was around 10,000 homeless people barely surviving in the area. But we're not here for a lesson in locations for fancy hotels. I'm here to tell you about the most haunted hotel in the world and its dark past. The Cecil Hotel has been a hotspot for all things strange, paranormal, and frankly quite sad, for a long time. With suicides, murders, conspiracies, all linked to its name, this particular hotel has it all. In 1931, a guest died in his room after taking poison capsules, and throughout the 40s and 50s, even more suicides occurred. It even got nicknamed the Suicide after many lives ended within its walls. In 1964, a long-term resident and well-known lady of the area was raped, stabbed, and beaten to death in her room. They thought they found the murderer, as a man was found covered in blood a few streets away. So they just assumed, I'm guessing.
Yeah, safely so, they just assumed.
But strangely, it wasn't him, and the case remains unsolved.
Did they figure out whose blood that was?
I have absolutely no idea. That's all it said on the matter. And I was just like, okay, just leave it there, why don't you? In the 1980s, a serial killer, Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, was a temporary resident. He stayed there throughout most, if not all, of his killing spree and was spotted around Skid Row quite often. Reportedly, he stripped off his bloodstained clothes outside the hotel and climbed the stairs in his blood-soaked underwear.
Nice.
Did he, like, do that in front of people and no one questioned him?
To be fair, by the sound of it.
People just mince about, covered in blood in the area, and everyone's like, oh, that's okay.
Oh, that's normal in these parts.
Yeah.
We're good.
Another serial killer, Jack Unterweger, stayed there in 1991. He strangled and killed three prostitutes and was later prosecuted of his crimes in Austria. He was also, apparently, meant to be some kind of copycat killer of Richard Ramirez. Kind of what I read about it, but no one's 100% sure. And he didn't really do the same kind of killings.
Was that, like, went to the Cecil Hotel because Richard Ramirez did?
I think so, yeah. In 2013, the Cecil, now rebranded as Stay on Main, was in the news once again as guests and residents complained about the smell, colour and taste of their water. Upon investigating the tanks, workers found the body of a young woman named Eliza Lamb. A Canadian student who had come to Los Angeles as a tourist. This story was huge. She'd been reported missing 19 days before she was found, and the media had released footage of her acting very strange in an elevator and talking to someone who wasn't there. There is so much mystery around her death, and even though it was stated that she died by drowning, the case remains unsolved. There has been at least 16 unexplained deaths in or outside of the hotel, from as early as 1931 all the way up to 2015, that are documented anyway. But some people have said that the Cecil could have claimed more. From Richard Ramirez to the Black Dahlia, apparently even Ted Bundy, it certainly has had its fair share of its links to horror. Somehow, drug deals, prostitutes and not-so-savoury people don't make it to the top reasons not to stay in this hotel. The Cecil, or what's known as Stay on Main, has had an overall 2-star rating on Google. Rooms come with a free breakfast and it has plenty of reviews to look at. Here's some that stood out for me. I hate this hotel. My friends forced me to go there. I heard about Eliza Lamb, but I still went. It was fine, but there was ants on my bed. 1-star. I stayed at this place before the Netflix Cecil Hotel docuseries came out. That was a mouthful. I'm from the East Coast and I was in town for a wedding / New Year's. I knew nothing about this place, but truth be told, I did not sleep well that night. There was something off and creepy about that hotel. Especially the hallways. My wife thought it was fine, but I'm not convinced. I couldn't put my finger on it. 1-star. Couldn't put your finger on it? Have you not heard about that hotel? Especially if you're travelling to Los Angeles.
If you were to say about haunted hotels, you would say the Cecil Hotel. Unless you're from the Midlands and you would say the Station Hotel.
Yeah.
Or if you're like, oh, where are we staying? I'll Google it. Boom. News article.
So many things would come up if you Googled that to be like, should I stay here? And everyone would say no.
That sounds like one of those things. His wife booked it and he went, where are we staying? There. Okay, cool. And that was it.
Yeah.
He just literally let his missus book it for him.
Yeah. Next one. When I stayed there, it was okay at first, but then I wanted to get up and get a drink. And I saw a strange figure in the hallway. It freaked me out. I've never been more scared staying at a hotel. It has a lot of history, and at night I kept hearing voices in my room, but no one was there. The bathroom door also shut by itself in the night, and stuff fell off the shelves. Wouldn't recommend this hotel. Stay at your own risk. 3-stars. Still give it 3 stars after having a shitty night.
My entire room was haunted. Shit got thrown at me. Doors were slamming. I was terrified. There was a figure in the hallway. But he still gave it a better rating than the guy that had some ants on his bed.
Oh, no, yeah.
He might have rated the experience. I mean, it was brilliant. I caught a ghost. Yeah. Fantastic.
It's like, I wouldn't go if I were you. It was all right for me. 3 stars.
Haunted, but the breakfast was nice. 3 stars.
Yeah.
A few ants on my breakfast.
Okay, last review. Me and my friend needed somewhere to stay on our journey home. Stay on Main was central to everything and has lots of history. I heard it's on Skid Row, but the people were really helpful and polite. The rooms were creepy, I'll give it that, but will definitely make for a great story for my experience there. Didn't die, so 5 stars. I love that.
They keep saying it has lots of history, but it's not good history. It's not like a historically wonderful hotel, is it? Like, it has lots of history.
But did you die, though?
Yeah.
Didn't die. 5 stars.
No, yeah.
That'd be my attitude to everything. Like, I am that sort of person. I'm like, didn't die.
The hotel is now closed to guests, but it has permanent residents living there. And I will butt in my own thing here to say, I literally saw a TikTok of someone filming outside the Cecil Hotel yesterday, and there was a man walking down the street in the middle of the night with a blanket wrapped around him, coming out of the hotel. It was like he just got up and went, nope, fuck this, I'm not staying there. He just got up and was walking down the street with the blanket wrapped around him, and he came out of the hotel.
Was he cold?
He must have been.
So I'm going to go join the homeless population. It'll probably be safer.
I know, yeah.
I've probably got less chance of dying there.
Mm. Yeah, you can still visit Stay on Main for a tour or a ghost hunt. TV's Ghost Hunters and Ghost Adventurers have both visited there for an investigation into the paranormal occurrences. According to everyone's favourite, Zach Baggins.
Good old Bill Baggins.
Richard Ramirez performed satanic rituals on the roof where Eliza Lamb was found. He said, when you are walking through these floors and nobody is there with you, even with the lights on, you can feel these spirits move through you and around you. They're watching you. There's just something about this building.
Did he also claim to have a fist fight with one of the ghosts? Like, Richard Ramirez's ghost appeared and he had a fist fight with him.
Yeah, obviously one. You know, he's got to have kicked his ass.
Obviously.
Yeah. Fucking chatting shit.
Stay on Main was also the inspiration for Ryan Murphy's season 5 of American Horror Story. The Hotel Cortez, home to serial killers, vampires and more, was based on the Cecil Hotel after Murphy heard about the story of Eliza Lamb and looked into this hotel's history. There are many reports of screaming, crying and whispers in the hallways of the room of the Cecil, as well as full apparitions, disembodied voices, shadows and even poltergeist activity. With its heart-wrenching and terrifying past, it's not surprising the Cecil Hotel is one of the most haunted places on Earth. Would you like to check in?
Yes.
Yes, I would for a laugh.
Absolutely, yeah. No chance. Actually, I'm lying there. I think I'd actually go there. Over that weird place in Wales you guys keep going on about.
Yeah.
To be fair, yeah.
I wouldn't get any reception in Wales, but I'd probably get it there.
That's the reason you wouldn't stay there. Every time we drive past the sign that says Welcome to Wales, your signal drops.
It doesn't like me.
And you never get it back. There's something about you that generally the country of Wales doesn't like.
Exactly.
I struggle for signal in Wales all the time.
To be fair, I struggle for signal in my kitchen. But Wales just cuts me off instantly. Doesn't like me.
I'd be like that person that did the review and it was like, I didn't die. 5 stars.
Yeah. Unless you did. Then I'd give it 5 stars.
I don't know. I think the ants bother me more than the ghosts, to be honest. I wouldn't like the ants.
I don't want the insects crawling on me.
I was tired enough with the ghosts.
Yeah.
Enough weird stuff happens in my house.
You could just picture Stace being in the bed and a ghost coming in. She'd just be like, oh, shut up.
No, but you just... Oh, dude, I've done my investigation now. You're too late. Fuck off. I'm going to sleep. Ah, there's ants on me. I'm getting out.
I'd be the person walking down the street in the...
Taking your quilt with you.
In the quilt, like, I'm not staying there. There's ants.
Anyway, moving swiftly on, we've got my first eerie theory. Eerie theory.
Eerie theory.
But anyway, this is the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. I'm probably butchering her name, but I'm just going to keep butchering it. I'm not going to change what I'm saying it now.
Black country slang,
I use. Yeah, it is eight. For this story, we're going back to the early morning of 26th of December, 1996, in the home of John and Patsy Ramsey, their son Burke, and their daughter JonBenet, in Boulder, Colorado. Patsy was walking down the stairs when she found a strange note. She started to read it and found that it was addressed to her husband John. The note read, "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We respect your business, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure you bring an adequate size bag to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money, and hence an earlier delivery pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you do not provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement, countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try and outsmart us. Follow our instructions and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Signed, Victory, SBTC. Sorry, I know that was long. This note was handwritten and was written on 3 pages. Patsy screamed to John that someone had taken their daughter and then rushed to check her bedroom and found her bed empty. They then ignored the note and called 911 and informed the police. Patsy told the operator, "We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please. There's a note left and our daughter's gone. She's 6 years old. She's blonde. She went on to tell them that the ransom had asked for $118,000, the exact amount of her husband's recent bonus. The Ramseys were a rich and attractive family, with their daughter, JonBenet, not only a kindergartner, but also a child beauty queen. Police arrived and spoke to the family, conducting a quick search of the house. When nothing was found, they left to start their investigation, asking John to conduct a more thorough search of the home. Just after 1 p.m, John found his daughter in the basement. She had been beaten and strangled to death. The police were called back, but as the case was initially assumed to be a kidnapping investigation, the crime scene wasn't preserved as well as it should have been, with people coming and going. Unfortunately, this led to a lack of evidence. This ultimately led to the death of JonBenet being unsolved for almost 30 years. The whole family willingly gave DNA samples to rule themselves out as potential suspects, and the DNA of an unknown male being found was used to prove that the family were not to blame. Unfortunately, the police were still not happy with the parents. The police were telling locals that there was no killer at large, trying to subdue fears. But the parents then went on to do a TV interview with CNN, telling viewers, "There is a killer on the loose. If I were a resident of Boulder, I would tell my friends to keep their babies safe. America is suffering because we have lost faith in the American family. We are a Christian, God-fearing family. We love our children. We would do anything for our children." In the coming months and years, despite the DNA evidence to the contrary, the parents were assumed by prosecutors to be the main suspects. Handwriting analysis ruled out John as the person who wrote the ransom note, but Patsy could not be ruled out. The coroner found a deep ligature around the victim's neck and another around the right wrist, evidence she was bound and strangled. Blood and abrasions were found in the girl's vaginal area, and she was struck on the head violently enough to cause bleeding and an 8.5-inch fracture to her skull, the autopsy states. Police also thought she may have been subdued with a stun gun. A poorly executed court case was started and eventually dropped due to a lack of evidence against the parents. JonBenet's brother was also cleared. In 2006, 10 years after her death, JonBenet's teacher confessed to murdering her. Thinking they finally found their man, police were very disappointed when they had to let the teacher go without any charges, as none of the DNA at the scene matched his. 2 years later, new DNA technology completely ruled out the parents as suspects, but unfortunately, the public opinion had already been swayed. JonBenet's father has repeatedly petitioned Colorado authorities to order new and more detailed DNA tests in an effort to find his daughter's killer. He spoke last year at CrimeCon, an annual weekend event for true crime enthusiasts, authors, and investigators, which, just side note, we need to go to that at some point.
Yes. Yeah, we need. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, never heard of CrimeCon.
Is that in America?
Yes.
We need a CrimeCon in this country.
We either need to start CrimeCon over here.
Yeah.
Or we need a road trip.
We should start
or
it.
Or both.
Yes.
Now, that would have been where the story ends, if I had covered it in any of our earlier episodes. But now, 3 weeks ago, there was a sudden new confession to the murder. Convicted paedophile Gary Oliva allegedly admitted to having an obsession with the child beauty queen and has sent a letter to an old friend admitting to the killing. This friend also claims that Oliva called him the night of the murder and confessed to hurting a little girl by accident, and that they called police to give them this information several times, but then nothing was done about it. Gary Oliva was getting his mail from a church around 13 houses away from the Ramsey residence at the time, and this is how he knew of JonBenet. The thing that shocked me most is that 4 years after her death, Oliva was arrested on the campus of the University of Colorado in Boulder. He was found with photos of JonBenet in his bag, along with a poem he had written about the girl called Ode to JonBenet, and a stun gun. John and Patsy Ramsey had hired a private investigator to investigate Gary Oliva, as the police weren't interested in him at the time because they were trying to pin it on the parents. and he was even photographed at the vigil that took place on the one-year anniversary of JonBenet's death. Gary Lever is currently serving a prison sentence for child pornography charges, and assuming any investigation that takes place going forward is conducted a lot better than everything that has been done so far, hopefully he will never get out. One thing we can all agree on is that the Colorado police did a terrible job on this investigation. From the original crime scene being ruined to spending too long ignoring other suspects due to their certainty the parents were to blame. Hopefully, poor JonBenet Ramsey will finally have the justice for an untimely death. One thing that struck me was, if he's in prison for child pornography charges, surely they would have taken some form of DNA sample. Would it not have flagged against other samples on other cases?
Just be on the system.
Yeah, they need some form of database that you put it in and it triggers any other cases that DNA matches.
When did DNA become big? Because I know it's only probably like in the past 20 years sort of a thing that we've looked into DNA.
It first started being used, I think, in the 80s and like early 90s, but obviously it's the last 20 years. It's been a big thing.
Yeah.
And it was very, very primitive back then. Like, they could kind of tell you very, very little. Oh. Whereas now it's a lot better. But
yeah. But that poor kid.
Yeah.
Absolutely heartbreaking.
And the police.
Rubbish.
Absolutely ridiculous. That they just assumed it must be the parents and just kept pushing it.
The arrogance of the police. Like, oh, we've got them, we're going to catch them out.
They found her in their basement.
Yeah.
He beat her, used a fucking stun gun on her, all in the house. Well, I'm assuming in the house, while they were all in it.
Yeah.
That's a huge house, though. You've got to think what the houses are like in America. Mm. Like, your standard houses are big. This guy clearly had money. It wouldn't have been like a mansion or something.
And if it was the family, like obviously the way the police were thinking about this, if it was the family, why would they go to the lengths of writing a 3-page ransom letter just to then find her body a few hours later?
To get their own money.
How did some random guy know his exact payment that he'd got? Was it like a bonus, did you say?
Yeah. If I remember rightly, he was living... he was living like kind of homeless, so he could have been going through their trash. He was in their house. He could have found a letter while he was in there, while he was writing the ransom note.
And why did he want it in like tens and twenties and stuff? Or
it
where?
Just it seemed to me like someone wrote a letter. How they think ransom letters are written. Mm. That's why it went on for so long.
Trying to get it all angles, kind of.
Yeah, they said most ransom letters are. We have your, in this case, it would have been, we have your daughter, don't call the police, we'll be in touch. And they have a phone call that then goes over all the stuff he mentioned in the letter. But instead, they wrote it all out in the letter. That's a bit that I didn't get. Why would you kill a kid, leave them in their own basement, and then write a ransom letter so it looks like she's gone missing? But they're going to find her.
Why would you not check the basement?
Mm. Also, why did the police not check the basement? Why did they leave the parents to check the rest of the house?
If he was obsessed with her, like he had, like, he wrote poems about her and had pictures of her and stuff, why did he kill her? Why did he say that he was going to do a ransom to give her back? Most things, like, in those kind of situations where it's like an obsession and stuff like that, it's not a kidnapping and I want a ransom for it. It's a kidnapping and you're staying with me. Mm-hmm. And it's hidden. They've just gone missing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed to be he was obsessed with her and she obviously had vaginal bleeding, meaning when he apparently called his friend and said he killed someone by accident, the theory was that people are kind of banded together that he tied her down while he did things to her because he said she had marks on her wrist showing that she'd been tied down and strangled. That meant he was kind of like, be quiet, trying to make her silent, basically. So he put something around her neck, and that's what kind of half killed her. But she was also had the fracture in her head, meaning either he finished her off thinking she was dying, or she wouldn't shut up and he kept banging her, just fucking hit her on the head with something. But generally, it didn't make sense to me that he left the body in the basement and then wrote a 3-page ransom letter. Unless he thought that maybe they weren't going to find the body yet. But why wouldn't they check their basement? Like, it doesn't... Most of it doesn't add up. It's weird.
The ransom, to me, actually does make sense. Because say if they found that it was a killing and they spotted that, you know, she'd been killed, first thing they would have probably done is look for pedos. Whereas, obviously, because there was a ransom note, they wouldn't have instantly jumped straight to the pedos
but
in the area.
Yeah. But it was the fact... But it was the fact that they wrote the ransom letter, but her body never left the house.
He was doing that to get attention away from himself, but possibly.
It said, we've got your daughter, we've kidnapped her. Where is she? Oh, she's in your basement, dead. Like, she never left. So they could have found the body within minutes of finding the note. They could have decided to search the house before they called the police, found the body instantly. And maybe they were hoping that they wouldn't find her and that they'd drop the money off first and then they'd find her and she was already dead. But there's also the fact that it was 7 hours between finding the note and finding the body. So there could have been someone hiding in the basement the whole fucking time, heard the police and went, yeah, fuck this, and killed her. She could have been being held hostage in their basement.
Did any of the reports say how long she was there for before they found her?
No, again, the police didn't do a very good fucking job. True. Very good investigation. It's probably on the file somewhere, like the police file, but they didn't say.
I googled the house and it's massive, by the way, so what you were saying about them probably not even hearing anything is about right.
Yeah.
He put her in the basement at some point while... Oh, did they were all in the house? I'm assuming this was on the note because she went and checked her bed.
Yeah, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. She found the note. 5-6 o'clock in the morning, she found the note.
Oh, God, so it could have been like overnight while they were asleep.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got in the house, done what he did maybe in the house, or did he take her out of the house? Did he come back with her? Either way, he's got in the house with people in it, took her, and then brought her back again with people in it.
Or just took her down to the basement, did what he did, and then got out. With people in it, no one
noticed. Either way, no one noticed him in the house.
Mm. The saddest thing for me was that this happened. They woke up the 26th of December, meaning that was Christmas night. She died.
Oh my God.
So she went to bed, having just had all of her presents from Santa, and then whatever happened, someone came into her room, did horrific things to her, and killed her.
Jesus Christ. Christ.
Poor girl.
Mm. I feel bad for the parents though as well. Like, obviously, you know, all this DNA evidence has highlighted that they're obviously innocent. So A, they had to find their child in that way for starters.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've spent years getting accused of, like, you know, being responsible and being vilified and, you know, probably, to be fair, like, let's be real, we all know how people treat pedos. So obviously they think the dad's a pedo. He would have been getting like his life would be hell. And then only for years later for them to go, you know, proves that it's not them. And they're just like,
yeah. They don't get like an apology or anything.
And the fact that the public opinion was already, yeah, but they probably did it anyway, didn't they? Like, people had already convinced themselves. And the girl's mom, Patsy, died before they were proven to be not responsible. So she died with everyone believing it was her.
Mm.
Which is disgusting. And she died obviously before finding out that any of this, like, someone could have actually now said, yeah, it was me. Which is disgusting.
I just can't believe all this came to light because someone actually admitted that. Like, I don't know, maybe because I'm like a normal human being, but I'd be like, why brag about that? Like, you killed a 6-year-old. That's grim. Absolute pussy.
Mm.
But from what I could tell, this was weeks ago that I found this out. As far as I know, the police haven't actually done anything about it yet.
No.
You just know there was a confession.
Mm. And it's not a confession to the police. It was apparently a confession to a friend. That they've got to verify that the friend is telling the truth and it's definitely for real and whatever. But there's evidence that they did call earlier on in the investigation to say, this person said that this has happened. They literally saw it on the news the next day, had got that phone call, rang the police and was like, I have some information, and they did nothing with it because they were so determined it was the parents that they ignored it. And obviously, because they thought that it was just a kidnapping, loads of people came in and out of the house and searched everywhere. There was footprints everywhere. There was DNA everywhere. There was no guarantee. There was no like checking for footprints of where this guy came in and out of the house throughout the night, because so many people had been in and out throughout the day before they found her. There was no way of pinpointing whose footprints were whose or whatever, whose fingerprints were whose. It was literally pointless. Everyone had been everywhere.
So. I kind of want to play the reverse Uno card here, and the inner conspiracy theorist in me is like, what about if it was one of the police officers and they deliberately fumbled the investigation?
Maybe.
I wouldn't be shocked.
That's why they were like, no, don't bother looking into facts and evidence. Just blame the parents.
Mm. I always wonder why police officers, or not necessarily the officers, detectives, whatever, you know, when they just blatantly ignore, like, someone going, I've got information, and you hear this in so many random cases, don't you? Someone's like, I called in, I told them this, and they're like, nah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why would you ignore it? What's your reason for ignoring it?
Yeah. If you ignore it as a police officer, you think that you have got enough evidence to convict the person who you think it is.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look into things.
But even
further.
That's confirmation bias, that like you only look at the information that confirms what you think, as opposed to, and you ignore any evidence that proves otherwise. Like, if it's something that proves like the contrary of what you believe, you can't just ignore it. You need to investigate it anyway. So it's, yeah. But anyway, let's move on to something a little bit more light-hearted.
Yeah. Is it?
It is a little bit. There's no kids involved, so I suppose that's
always
better. Yeah, so my one is actually a kind of like merge of true crime and possible spook. But I'll tell you guys a story and you can kind of tell me your thoughts afterwards.
Okay.
So first off, I'm going to set the scene. It's Hammersmith in London, right in the middle of winter, which at the time was actually a relatively new village. So they'd only recently fully established it, so it was still quite a small area. And they'd been dealing with loads of reports of ghostly activity. So they'd been seeing, like, there'd been sightings reported and apparently physical attacks. So I'll tell you some of the stories of the ghost and then what happened because of it all. So there was one story of a 8-horse wagon driver, so I suppose it was the 1800s equivalent of a bus, and he was going down the road. He apparently saw the spectre of this ghost and went, nope, and dipped. Left his horses, left his passengers, and just dipped.
Bloody hell.
Bye, hon. I'm off.
Jesus.
Yep. Fuck this shit, I'm out.
Literally, yeah.
I don't get paid enough for this, bye.
She dipped. And then there was another story, and this one's actually one of my favourites. It's a man called Thomas Groom. He was walking through a graveyard. He had his hands in his pockets. He was minding his own business. It was in the middle of the night, and obviously winter, so dark. And he, out of nowhere, someone from behind a graveyard, two hands, grabbed him by the throat. And the motion of how they grabbed him managed to spin him around. So most people, their reaction would be to throw a punch. So he throws this punch, and he said it felt like he'd punched through a coat. It was a very descriptive explanation. And then obviously he goes to investigate, because he's like, who is this person trying to attack me? So naturally you go running, well, fight or flight. He chose fight, and there was no one there. So he punched, it felt like he punched through like material or a coat. Nobody was there. And it's not like they could have run away quick enough, you know, you would have heard them running, but nothing. So
He threw hands. With a ghost.
He threw hands. Threw hands.
You catch these hands, boy?
But I'd pay money to see that. Can you imagine, like, you're sat there, like, you know, putting flowers to a relative or something. I don't really do that in the middle of the night, but you're like,
I was
like,
gonna say, why was he in the graveyard?
I think it was like a cut
through. Yeah, he was walking through.
But can you imagine, like, you're like, you know, doing a nightly visit to like your nan or something, like, hi nan, and then there's just a man like punching the air.
Oh, shit, I forgot nan's birthday, let's take some flowers after my shift.
Why is there a man punching the air?
To be fair, in Birmingham you see a man punching the air in a graveyard, you're like, yeah, that's probably normal. Like, that's an everyday thing around here.
Drugs.
He's either on drugs or he's had too much to drink. Like, that's an everyday occurrence.
Spicy.
Yeah.
And then this one is actually a slightly sadder story. It's not quite as funny. There was a pregnant woman who was cutting through a churchyard where she saw a white spectre. So she sees this white spectre and she's like, fuck this shit, I'm out. Dips. And it catches up to her, gives her a little cuddle.
Oh.
Yeah. The way it was described was that it brought her into its arms. So I'm just saying, give her a little cuddle, you know, a little snuggle. Okay. And she passed out. And then her neighbours found her. They woke her up because she was still, you know, sort of conscious. So they woke her up, brought her home. You know, they kind of calmed her down, brought her to bed. And then she never woke up afterwards. So she was awake for a bit to tell people what happened. And then...
So, you know, when you said not quite as funny. That's not funny.
No, it's not. It's actually pretty sad.
You're like, it's not quite as funny. She just died. It's fine.
Exactly.
Note to self, don't hug the ghost.
No, don't hug a ghost.
But that really was a struggle cuddle.
It was, yeah. Part of me did wonder, though, like, the rational side of me here did wonder, because obviously you can, like, you know, have, like, heart attack and things like that. Her body would have already been going through a lot because she was pregnant. And obviously back in the 1800s, diagnostic medicine wasn't where it was back then.
Yeah.
So it could have been just a lot of stress on her system. And then she calms down because of all the adrenaline, and then boom, you know. Yeah.
It sounds very similar to one of the stories I did in one of the not-so-lives of the stagecoach driver that had a passenger that was like, run, you know, go as fast as you can, fast as you can, they're chasing me. So he drives off as quick as he can, and he can hear the carts and the horses and the people, and then eventually stops. There's nothing there. And he turns back, and there's nothing there. And he's like, what the fuck? And he, like, the next day, died.
Jesus.
And then, like, everyone was like, oh, did he die? I mean, maybe not the next day, but a couple of days later, they were like, I think he died of fright, or just died of fucking stress or something. Like, something fucked him up.
Yeah.
It's very similar, like, just so fucking scared, they slowly died.
And then now we'll get to the true crime element of this story. So, naturally, after a while, all these stories were coming about, and the locals were, like, actively avoiding locations where there were sightings. They didn't want to go out. And it was just kind of a very scary and stressful time. So a bunch of locals, they banded together and they started to become patrollers, because they had, some people believed it was a ghost, and then others had a theory that it was some Scooby-Doo shit and it was just someone walking around in a sheet.
They were the original Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Ghostbusters!
That's where it started.
And I'm literally just picturing it, though. Can you imagine? Like, even back in the 1800s, surely they must have been like, that's a man in a sheet. So they started setting up actually armed patrols as well. This is how annoyed they were getting, because back then you could carry guns in England. And so they wanted to either catch the person that was doing it or prove it was a ghost or do something. I don't even know what they were thinking. Like, if it was actually a ghost, what were they going to do?
I know, we've already got proof that you can't punch a ghost. Like, they're going to shoot one.
Maybe they had special bullets.
Maybe.
Or holy water.
Invisible bullets.
Water pistol. Yeah. Holy water pistol.
So, all of this is happening with the different investigators. And one of the patrollers had apparently said that they'd seen the ghost, so they chased it. And apparently they saw someone throw off a sheet and run off. And it was one of them, so, you know, apparently no one else saw this, so people are like, I was a bit like, really? Are you just selling your story? Are you justifying you being outside with a gun?
Are you just trying to be part of it?
Yeah, like, are you sure you're not just getting in on the party?
I want to play too.
So now I've got to tell the main true crime story. There's a couple of names, so you'll just have to, I'm going to say their full names, and then I'll probably go to their surnames afterwards. So, by the 3rd of January, 1804, Francis Smith, a resident who was very fed up, and he was determined to stop the ghost, the Boo Ghost. And how did he prep for this patrol? Got hammered, got utterly gazeboed, went to the pub, and then started walking around legit with a gun. Why not?
Sensible.
Jesus Christ.
Reasonable.
I mean, why not?
And then to tell the story of another person, there was a bricklayer named Thomas Millwood who was in the area, and back then bricklayers would wear all white linen outfits. So of course, numerous times this poor man would be walking home from work and he would get shouted at, like, literally, apparently someone went past and went, "Oh, you're the ghost." And he went, "Do you want a punch in the head?" Because he was just fed up of it.
Typical Bricky.
I know, yeah. Typical Bricky, to be fair. And it happened to him a couple of times. And his wife had actually said to him, "Why don't you just wear a coat or something over your clothes? Or, you know, change his uniform." Like, I think if I went to my work and said, my people are shouting at me because of my uniform, my work would be like, "Say less, you can wear a different colour or something." But
yeah.
Didn't think about that. So his wife told him to wear a coat. He was like, "No." And just carried on walking around in his white outfit.
The
moral of this story, listen to your wife.
Yes.
And on, so going back to the date of January 3rd, we have Mr. Smith. He was on his duty. Obviously, you can't see my inverted commas, but I'm saying duty. While hammered and annoyed, he met another one of these patrollers called William Girdler and told him about his determination to hunt down this ghost, the OG ghost hunters, and managed to rope this guy in.
Do you want to come with me?
He was like, "Yeah, go on then. They'll probably both drunk."
I know.
And they set up a code as well, so that, because it was like winter in England in the 1800s, so it was obviously quite dark. And so they set up a code. So I think the code was one of them would go "advance" and the other one would go "advance, friend." And they'd know it was them. So they just say that to each other.
"I've got the mental image of two pissed off blokes stumbling around the graveyard at night. Advance, friend."
I'm kind of sad that they weren't like, you make the sound of a pigeon and I'll make the sound of a crow. Maybe they did do that, and then there was an actual pigeon, and they're like, "Was that you? There's too many fucking pigeons. We need a different code."
Maybe, yeah. So they had this code, and they were going around looking for it. And they, I think at one point they'd like divided and conquered, because obviously it's still quite a large area. And
they'd advanced in different directions.
As friends.
Yeah. Got drunk and got lost.
Basically. So on this fateful night, poor Thomas Millwood was going to see family while these two drunken idiots were walking around. And he goes to see family and he's in his work uniform and he leaves his family home. And his sister's looking out the window, just waving him off, you know, "Bye." And then within a few minutes, she hears shouting. Like, "What are you? Who are you?
Advance, friend."
Exactly. And then she sees a flash and hears a loud bang and then goes out to find out what's happened and then obviously finds her brother, sadly, obviously dead. So Mr. Smith, the genius, dipped and went to the pub.
Jesus Christ.
He's like, "I've done it. Kill the ghost. I'm off for a drink."
Exactly. And I think that is kind of how it was described. Like, he was all like, "Oh, I've shot the ghost." And then the other one, Girdler, who wasn't with him at the time, went, "If you shot him, are you sure that was a ghost?"
Yeah.
Kind of like logical for a second. So then they went back and then he realised that, wait, that was a person. And so they took him to a surgeon who was at the pub.
Jesus Christ.
Everyone's in the pub.
Everyone's in the pub.
Welcome to Britain.
Yeah.
This is a bad representation of Britain, but it's actually just literally Britain.
It's actually the perfect representation of Britain.
They probably
spoons.
Yeah.
We'll just go to the Winchester and wait for all of this to blow over.
That's probably where that guy was trying to fight that coat. Like, he wasn't even outside. He was just in the pub, pissed, fighting a coat stand.
I guarantee you that guy's hood blew round. And he got, "Oh, shit."
He's like, "What the fuck's that?"
He punched himself in the coat.
He did have a coat under his arm.
There you go.
Fucking tit.
I wonder if you made the sound effects. Pew, pew, pew. But this bit isn't funny. It's really sad he got shot.
No, but it's funny that they were like, they took him to the pub and they shot him through the jaw. So that was where.
So he couldn't even have a drink.
No, he couldn't even have a drink.
All the drink had poured out of his face.
They shoot a guy who they think is a ghost. They go to the pub.
Yeah.
They come back from the pub to make sure it was a ghost. It wasn't a ghost. It was a person. So they take the person who they've just shot to the pub, to the surgeon in the pub.
Yeah.
To try and save him in the pub.
Yeah. They couldn't save him.
And obviously, oddly enough, unfortunately, the surgeon's twatted because he's been in the pub all day, probably buying the guy's drinks for finally killing a ghost.
Yeah. Oh, it's fine, it's just a grace. It'll be all right.
I'm pretty certain, again, speaking of things we covered on the Not So Lives, I'm pretty certain I covered this as one of their paranormal true crimes. But the ghost that was haunting people, that turned out to not be a ghost haunting people, that is now actually a ghost that haunts that graveyard.
If I was him, I would now be that ghost, I would say.
So there's now tales of a ghost that haunts that graveyard because he was killed in the graveyard.
And I would definitely be aiming for drunk people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd have it in for them.
He's also apparently not only haunts the graveyard, but even haunts the local pub.
I was going to say, the pub.
So even his ghosts get
pissed.
That's
why we need to do an investigation. Be like, for Thomas!
Yeah. Everyone's in that fucking pub.
Yeah.
So chances are all their ghosts have gone back.
Exactly. So obviously, poor man passed away, and Mr. Smith, to his credit, did actually own up to what he'd done. He said that he didn't realise he was a ghost. And then obviously it went to court, and he pled not guilty because he was like, oh, I didn't realise that he was a person. I thought he was a ghost. And then the judge kind of came out and said, you took a loaded gun to kill a ghost. You obviously had intention to shoot somebody, so it was put down as willful murder.
Mm.
And then the jury, he pulled on their heartstrings because apparently he did genuinely feel so guilty, like he was racked with guilt. So they tried to put it down to manslaughter, and the judge was like, nope, either you do him for murder or you acquit him. There's no in between. You have to do one or the other. And he kind of used a couple of examples. He was like, if a police officer shot a burglar or something like that, he could have like subdued him, but didn't. He shot him. That's murder. And he kind of went through a few examples, and I was like, pop off, judge. So he got sentenced to murder, and he was due to be hung. But again, this pulled on the heartstrings of a lot of people, so it got taken to the crown, and the king changed his sentence from hanging to 1 year of hard labour.
Did he actually do it, or did he just go to smoke?
And say, was it in the pub?
Oh, no, yeah.
The hard labour was in the pub.
Probably.
It was literally, spend a year in the pub, but you can't drink.
Oh.
That's hard labour.
That is hard labour, to be fair.
That's terrifying.
Well, in actual fact, I went to a jail in Oxford. So it was Oxford Castle and it was Oxford Jail. And they showed some examples of the hard labour they actually used to make you do. And the hilarious bit about it is it's all pointless.
Yeah.
Like, so one of the rooms that we saw was this wheel that they had to spin. And it's literally so heavy, it warped the floor. So the floor looked like wavy, and it was because how heavy this wheel was, and they just have to spin it all day, and there was no purpose to it. And then there was another one that was a stepper, and you had to hit so many steps a day. I was like, to be fair, booty gains.
Stepper's a good one.
Yeah. And there was another one where you had to carry a cannonball around, and it wasn't that heavy, but I think after carrying it for like 5-6 hours, it would have been.
I'd seen a few where there's literally just like piles of massive rocks, and it's like, pick up the rocks, move them over there. And then when they've finally moved all the rocks, you're like, okay, go pick them back up, bring them back up.
At
just do that all day, every day.
It's going to be useful to society.
Yeah.
I think that's why they've got things like
litter picking, community service.
Yeah.
As opposed to hard labour. It's boring labour.
Yeah. But they tried to do it so that it was kind of pointless. So it's kind of like you felt like you wasted a year of your life working really hard for nothing.
You work stupidly hard and you're not even helping.
By the sounds of it, though, you'd be fucking hench after any of them.
Yeah.
So.
In fairness. So I suppose that's something to aim to.
Hench to go fight the ghost that you didn't
And you've worked up a massive thirst for when you go to the pub later on. Because all that hard labour, you're going to need a drink.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. But that is the tragic story of the ghost that ended up actually being a ghost. But the theory I want to pose to you guys is, what do you think of the original ghost stories? Because there was multiple theories that it was actually a prankster. So there was one person who had been caught after all this had happened, and he was literally wearing a sheet and going around and winding people up.
I did hear about that.
Yeah, I think it was probably lots of hearsay. One person had a weird experience and told everyone in the fucking pub, which that apparently was everybody. It's a very small case of mass hysteria.
Yes, I was just going to say that. It's like on a tiny mass hysteria.
Everybody kind of jumped on the bandwagon without realising and had their own experience. and it just snowballed into this big thing. And then obviously, same as most cases, you have people that say they've had an experience because they want to be part of the story, they want to be involved. They want to sit and talk to people at the pub about what they saw compared to everyone else. And but generally, I don't think there was actually a ghost, whereas now there probably is.
Yeah.
Because someone got shot in a graveyard. So what you got for us then, Stace?
Well, mine's a little bit different. It involves kids. But no, kids dying, so that's a good
that's
one.
That's always good. Better than mine.
So, Braden claims to be his great Uncle John reincarnated. Now, I got this information just as like a bit of context to the subject that I'm talking about. This information is from the University of Virginia, who have case files of over 2,500 children. And this is what they've put on the subject. Some young children, usually between the ages of 2 and 5, speak memories of a previous life. At the same time, they often show behaviours such as phobias or preferences that are unusual within the context of their particular family and cannot be explained by any current life events. These memories appear to line up with the statements the child in question makes about a previous life. In many cases, the statements a child has made have been shown to match up with the life and death of a dead person. Some children even have birthmarks or birth defects that correspond with wounds or other marks of the deceased person whose life is being remembered by the child. In numerous cases, post-mortem reports have confirmed this. Memories these children have generally seem to fade around the age of 7, and cases of children who experience past life memories have been reported all over the world. So let's get on to Braden. Braden had memories that only his great Uncle John would have known. Uncle John was murdered 7 years before Braden was even born. At the age of 5, Braden started having dreams about what happened the night of the murder that did not match what investigators had told the family. Upon inspection of the clothing the police had handed back to the family, once the investigation had concluded and a suspect was charged for his murder, the family noticed some strange things that didn't match up to what the police had told them. Police failures, like, again, it's a bit of a...
Yeah, it seems to be a pattern.
Bit of a theme in this one, isn't it? The police had concluded that Great Uncle John had been shot in the front of his chest. However, the bullet hole on the back of his shirt was as big as an adult male's pinky finger. There was a perfect black circle around this bullet hole. The bullet hole in the front of Great Uncle John's shirt was much bigger than the one on the back of his shirt and was all blown out and shredded. Now for the science. Exit wounds are generally larger than entrance wounds because on impact a bullet can expand or turn on its axis. The ring on the back of John's shirt also indicates that he was shot at point blank range in the back. Braden described being shot in the back during his past life. One day, whilst out at a local farm with his aunt, Braden became distressed, emotional and frightened. He hid behind his aunt, and when asked by his aunt what was wrong, he pointed to a man and said that the man they saw was the man who had shot and killed him. Had they arrested the wrong person for Uncle John's death? The family are now convinced that the story the authorities gave them was not true, and that Great Uncle John had been reincarnated as Braden to come back and tell them the truth through Braden. During an interview for the documentary The Ghost Inside Me, Braden introduced himself and said, "I am 7 years old. I am in the second grade. Uncle John died across the road from a church where the high school is. He died in a yellow house. I sleepwalk like Uncle John. I act bad like Uncle John. And how I know this is my dreams. John can go through me. I don't feel like him, but when he goes through me and stays in me, I feel like a ghost." Now, if my kid came out with something like that, I'd be totally freaked out, especially if it matched up with real life events that had actually happened.
I think on a slightly... I believe that, like, kids can be reincarnated and things like that. I believe all of that. But on a slightly sceptical side, just for this case in particular, or well, generally any case from kids that I don't personally know, how much have the parents or the family put in his head? How much have they talked about Uncle John? How many conversations has he overheard? How much have they go, oh, you look a bit like Uncle John. Who's Uncle John? This guy and blah, 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 blah. And
yeah,
he then clung on to it and had dreams about it and then played on the fact that it, they're like, oh, that's weird, that's suspicious. Oh, I'm getting attention. And played on it and made it seem bigger than it is.
If they hadn't told him any details at all, I mean, generally, would you tell? How old did you say he was?
Seven.
Would you tell Charlie?
No. But that's what I mean.
As far as I'm concerned, the impression that I got from watching the documentary was that they hadn't really told him about Uncle John or mentioned Uncle John. One, because it happened 7 years before Braden was born, and two, because I feel like it was quite a sore subject within the family and within the community, because Uncle John was a bit of a tearaway. He was a bit of a Jack the Lad who was known for getting in trouble and getting himself into these situations. So I do think it was the fact of, you know, they're all grieving for so many different reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, like I said, it's not that I don't believe that that's a thing, or that I don't even necessarily not believe this kid, but it's one of those, unless you know the family and you were in that situation, if that was happening to me with one of our kids, I'd believe it 100%.
Yeah.
As soon as it happens to someone I don't know the circumstances around it to believe it 100%. I don't know how creepy or spooky it is because I wasn't there. I don't know the circumstances. But still fucking weird.
Absolutely.
If we take their word for how much they actually said or told him, that's weird.
So, we're going to end with the two sentence horror stories that we all love. This one is from BeautifulDawn888 on Reddit. When my dad, suffering from Alzheimer's, started repeating women's names, even calling me by them, I wondered if he'd had affairs in the past. But I learned the truth when his garden was being excavated and a collection of driver's licenses were found in his bedside drawer.
No!
Nice. Gross. Sounds like Mambo number 5.
Mm.
they're not girls he slept with, they're girls in his garden.
Fuck yeah.
Anyway, my sister told me that Mommy killed her. Mommy told me I've never had a sister.
Bloody hell.
Maybe she's in his garden.
They celebrated the first successful cryogenic freezing. He had no way of letting them know he was still conscious.
Oh, my fuck.
That's terrifying. That's a bit like, you know, the people that have that anaesthetic, but they're still awake. And they can't speak.
Can feel everything.
They can feel everything, but they can't move or speak.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's horrific. You know, there's actually, sorry, completely off topic again, but there's actually a theory that everyone has that during anaesthetic, but that you forget it when you wake up. So that you always, through every operation, you're actually completely conscious and can feel everything. You just can't speak and tell everybody, but then you forget the entire ordeal. So you don't know that you've gone through that.
Nope.
That's terrifying to think about.
I've never been under anaesthetic where I've been knocked out, and I don't want to be. Especially not after that.
Just in case.
Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ.
Same.
And they couldn't wake me up.
I woke up to the sound of knocking on glass. I looked out of the window, then I heard it again. It was coming from my mirror.
Oh my god, that's creepy. This one is from IrishWoman94, again on Reddit. The most recent time he punched me, my boyfriend wept as he promised he would never hit me again. As I added the rat poison to his dinner, I knew that for once he would actually keep his promise.
Yas, queen! Like yas!
This one proper creeped me out. I wake up in the middle of the night and my wife is not next to me. I check and the kids are gone too. Everything is silent. I look out of the window to find them all standing outside, staring up at me. My son points at me, or so I thought, as the door slams behind me and all of the lights go out.
What the fuck?
Sorry. That was creepy.
What is creepy? I need, like...
People have to know.
I know, I need a story.
This one's quite creepy as well, actually. My mother has been screaming at the front door for hours now. I don't think she's happy that I killed her with my bare hands.
Fucking hell.
Maybe you didn't do a very good job.
Yeah. Oi!
Dear. As I played in the cellar, my mum called me upstairs. Then from behind me, she whispered, "Don't go up there."
I've heard a few variations of that.
Yeah. That one always gives me the ick.
I heard my mum calling me from downstairs, and when I went down there, she came out of her room and said, "Don't go down there." I heard it too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, shit, which one is it?
It's like, nope.
I'm going to bring it down a bit now with this one. Again, from Irish Woman 94 on Reddit. There are certain lies that are okay to tell a child. The Tooth Fairy, Santa. "We'll be safe in here," I whisper to my terrified students, as gunshots echoed through the hallway. "We'll be okay."
Oh, no, that's so sad.
That was fucking horrific.
Yeah.
That was awful.
That's too fucking true. It's fucking ridiculous.
It actually happened.
After years of research and hard work, we'd finally done it. We made it contagious.
Oh, Jesus.
It's a bad one, right?
COVID.
This one proper gave me the ick. You know that full body twitch you get sometimes as you're falling asleep?
Always.
Yep.
If you had a camera pointed at you and you saw what it captured during that moment, you'd never sleep again.
Fuck off.
I feel like I've got to film that now just to see.
You put a camera up and it wouldn't happen for months.
Yeah.
Yeah,
to be fair. Well, the camera would go off and then it'd happen and you'd be like, no, that's even worse.
My story's going to creep you out. If you get scared at night, don't keep your eyes closed for too long. There's a reason you're scared, and now you can't see it approach.
Oh, God.
I'd still rather not see it approach.
Didn't say. I don't think you want to see it approach.
I'm not seeing it. I can live with that. Or die with that. It's fine.
Well, then you got the last one.
I've got the last two sentence horror story. I told the genie that I wanted to be hard all of the time. And I mean it, you know, the guy way. So, hard all of the time and get all the ass that I wanted. I didn't mean to be turned into a toilet seat, though.
I like it.
Fab. I thought that was going in another direction.
Yeah, they were going to be like a dildo or something.
No, I was thinking constipation, to be fair. Hard all the time and get all the ass that I wanted.
Yeah.
So that was the end of our first Eerie Theories episode with everybody together. I think that went okay. I say it's the first. Tell a lie, it's actually the second time we've filmed this one, because for some reason that all of the sound just completely malfunctioned. So we had to pretend like we never heard... Well, no, actually, I was going to say we had to pretend like we'd never heard it all before, but it was at least over a week since we last recorded it, and we've all got memories like goldfish, and we forgot what everyone was talking about.
Yeah.
So it was literally like hearing it all for the first time.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So this is why I have to listen back to it while I'm editing. It's still a surprise for me. Like, wow, I don't remember that story.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that was yesterday. But anyway, so speaking of other episodes and listening back, I have just added a poll to our last Illuminate Me episode. So for anyone that has listened to it or hasn't listened to it yet, if you listen to it, please answer the poll question. Let us know what your favourite conspiracy theory was from that episode. I'm going to add another poll to this episode over on Spotify. Let us know what your favourite two-sentence horror story was that we mentioned. Yes, send us some other two-sentence horror stories that, you know, we haven't mentioned yet, we haven't read out before. Write some yourself, make some up. If you're, you know, the creative kind, drop us a message on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook or wherever you can find us. Give us a like, follow, review, wherever you're listening to us. It really helps us. Kind of helps spread the message, gets us out there, gets more people to listen to us.
Find our tribe.
Yeah. Share it. Show some people. Be like, "Oi, you, listen to this podcast." Just drive down the street, shout it at people. Whatever, you know, just...
Get a sandwich board and a bell.
Yeah, just stand there.
If you're a
true
fan, you would.
hey ye, listen to Paraverse now, bitches. Just...
And shout out to all the international followers.
Yes, we've actually got more listeners over in the States than we have in the UK, which is weird. And I bet most of you were loving mine and Stacey's accent.
I was
going to
say, it's
one.
The accent, isn't it?
It's definitely
that's
the
why
accent.
You listen.
The amazing British accent, Aid.
The black country accent.
I apologise.
Nathan Stacey's accent is not a true representation of Birmingham and Britain.
And is not the official accent
of
Paraverse.
It's not standard Queen's English, is it?
Tay, is it?
Tay, is it? Well, it's the King's now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tay, the Queen's now, Moa.
I don't think the King spikes like this either, those days. He don't spike like this, does he?
Bet the King do have a cup of Tay.
Oh.
Anyway.
Me and Tash are just like, oh my God.
Oh, it's disgusting. Anywho, thanks for listening. Go listen to another podcast, find another episode. There's so many. You can scroll back. There's 2-hour-long episodes where we talk about certain subjects. So we've got loads of guests, really interesting interviews. We've got so many not-so-live episodes where me and Stu have talked about loads of really interesting, cool, quirky little things. There's loads of Illuminate Me episodes now.
There's our Skywatch video on YouTube as
yeah,
well. That
go,
was a fun night.
Go watch
brilliant night.
I can't trace Skywatch / Paranormal Investigation.
You want to put a face to a name, you know?
Yeah.
A name?
Put a face to a voice. Come and watch us. Phone us on Facebook. We're going to be doing some more lives again soon. Normally, well, we used to do lives every week, but it'll probably be once a month now. We're going to be doing live shows again. There's generally every social media network you can think of. We're on it. We have content on there. We've got some, I've been slowly started adding some spooky, scary, true ghost stories on TikTok. There's loads of different stuff out there, so find us wherever you can and interact, drop us a message, comment, log, review, whatever. Spread the love.
Also, for the readers out there, you should check out The Unexplained Paranormal Encounters in the UK, written by our very own Nathan Lockley.
I was going to say, who wrote that?
Yeah.
The book sounds a bit shite, I wouldn't read that.
There's an author in the midst who refuses to blow his own trumpet at all.
We need to do that. His book is brilliant. I've read it.
It's very, very good book.
We should do that on a live soon.
I might mention it, maybe. It is, for anyone that does actually want to read it, it is available on Amazon all over the world. So just type in The Unexplained Paranormal Encounters in the UK and you'll be able to get yourself a copy. Or drop us a message and I can sort you out a signed copy if you want me to scribble in a book for you.
There you go.
Right then, and on that note, we'll see you all soon.
Love you, bye.